Hello and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding areas. This is the primary edition for the week ending September the 5th, 2020. My name's Ian, I edit and produce this programme. As last month, this edition is being produced from my holiday home on the contentious, as far as the UK government is concerned, Balearic island of Menorca, so apologies if the sound quality is a bit different. Interestingly, thanks to the miracle of the digit and email, it's just as straightforward to make the programme from here, in fact almost easier, as Menorca has a fantastic fibre internet setup. Life on Menorca continues as before, although the COVID infection rate is sadly up, mainly due to the influx of Spanish tourists from mainland Spain. This week we'll see them returning home as the Spanish schools reopen. In addition, the German government has forbidden travel to the Balearics, so, in the west of the island, which normally sees a large number of German tourists, the sunbeds will be getting a reprieve. Mask wearing continues, and it's become second nature now. It's terrible to see the effect that the pandemic has had on the island. Nearly 80% of Menorca's income is from tourism, and there will be, as in the UK, some businesses that will never recover. Mahon, the capital, should be busy and bustling with holidaymakers and passengers from cruise ships. Today, it feels like a ghost town. The weather has been glorious and baking, often 35 degrees. That's 95 in proper degrees Fahrenheit. I am planning to return to the UK this weekend, so hopefully the October edition of Primary will return to normal. The good news is that this will again be distributed, as it was in the olden days, on USB sticks. Please remember to return them in the wallet provided when you have finished listening. It helps us all enormously. Additionally, the programme is available on our website, sadtn.org.uk, under Listen Online. If you are using a mobile device, it's available via the British Wireless for the Blind Fund app. This can be downloaded free via iTunes or Google Play. Search for Talking Newspaper. Once you've installed the app, open it up, select East of England, then scroll down until you find the two entries for St Albans. You can also hear the news from the Hertfordshire Advertiser and the Review on Radio Verulam 92.6 in a programme ably hosted by our very own Rob Pearman on Fridays at 7 p.m. We'll have the usual news roundup and the national radio listings read by John Cushing. And once again, we'll be delving into the Vocalise London Beyond Sight archives. This time it's Zoe Wanamaker describing Bush House in London. I'll also be playing an American Vocalise piece, with the president of the Manhattan Chamber of Commerce describing the Chrysler Building. It's the most beautiful Art Deco building, my favourite, and rumour has it that it's going to become a hotel. The curator of the St Albans Museum, Sarah Keeling, will take us on a guided tour of the building, and to finish, I'll be looking at past events and birthdays in the week. This week's music is Sentimental Blues by Goffby. But first the news read by Gilly, Steve, Wendy, Deborah, Christine, Jane and myself.
Hello, I'm Gilly. My first story is called It's Paradise for Stalkers. A St Albans woman whose details and naked pictures have been shared on an online forum has described it as a stalker's paradise and said it was mortifying to find revealing photos of her were being shared online. The female victim, who will not be named, says she was warned by a friend that her pictures were being circulated on the internet and was sent a link to an online forum. The forum is used to anonymously request and post naked or revealing photographs of women in Hertfordshire, with posts requesting pictures from specific locations, namely Stevenage, Hitchin, Welwyn or St Albans. The victim said, "It was mortifying to find this. It's really creepy that people I don't know have so much personal information about me and other girls. I think it's like a stalker's paradise." She found one picture of herself that she took more than 10 years ago when she was just 15 on the forum, alongside posts that named her and were requesting more pictures to be sent. Alongside this victim's picture, there are hundreds of other women pictured, with anonymous users posting as recently as last week. Some posts name a specific woman and the location they are known to live in, then request other users to send in any of their pictures. One user said, Anyone got any St Albans to share? I've got some. Name redacted. Another asks, who's the girl in the last photo? She looks familiar. Would love to see this. Name redacted. Dunno if it's the same one I know. The victim says she and others have reported this to the police, but have not had much luck so far. A spokeswoman for Hearts Police said, police are aware of the website and are making inquiries at this time. The charity Victim Support offers advice to people who have had their images posted without their consent.
Pubs and musicians from across the district are joining forces to raise awareness of the challenges they are facing in the wake of the pandemic. The shutdown of the hospitality industry had a devastating effect on pubs, but also curtailed live music from being performed in many venues. Pubs have always been a platform for bands and musicians, but now this has become more apparent than ever as the two struggling industries have discovered how much they rely on each other. One music venue that has suffered the most in St Albans is The Horn. They book their gigs a year and a half in advance and rely on two or three a week just to break even. Ultimately, this has affected the musicians and bands who showcase themselves. Enter Shikari, Paul Young, The Subways, Friendly Fires and The Gallows are just a few of the artists who began their careers at The Horn and other small music venues and attribute much of their success to these platforms. Rob Rolfe, drummer for Enter Shikari, couldn't have said it better. If it wasn't for music pubs, Enter Shikari would not exist. That's where we cut our teeth. We were playing the pub circuit and building our fan base around the country when we started to get recognised by the industry. They are essential not just for artists to have a stage to play on, but for communities to come together and share in the spirit and value of live music. The venue has remained closed until this week, but music will be off the cards until next summer at the earliest, unless a vaccine is introduced sooner. With the help of crowdfunding, The Horn has managed to survive, but other venues may not be so lucky. The Save St Albans Pubs campaign was initially set up approximately 4 years ago to provide a platform to lobby central government on a wide variety of issues, mainly business rates reform and reducing beer duty. But the pandemic forced the campaign to expand its remit and form the St Albans Independent Hospitality and Retail Association to support venues through the crisis. Last Saturday at the White Lion in Sopwell Lane, local band The Maid of Vales jumped at the opportunity to donate their time and talent in order to raise money for the campaign and bring the two industries back together again. Paul Littler of The Maid of Vales said, "Pubs and venues mean so much to so many people for so many reasons. As a musician, they provide an integral space for us to perform and hone our art, whilst building and nurturing our local community. We must come together to fight for our heritage venues." Save St Albans Pubs co-founder Sean Hughes said the campaign will be sending a letter to the Chancellor calling for continued support, specifically for pubs with VAT to continue at 5% with the addition of alcohol until April 2022. Immediate planning grants for marquees for listed and Article 4 pubs, zero business rates for pubs until April 2022, and the Eat Out to Help Out scheme to return in January and February.
Hello, this is Wendy, and my first story is joy as road accident black spot is finally set for safety improvements. A Coney Heath councillor is celebrating the end of a long-running battle for safety improvements at a notorious accident black spot. Councillor Chris Brazier has been campaigning for potentially life-saving changes to the longabout on the A414 for more than a decade, and now something is finally being done. Councillor Brazier said for motorists entering and exiting Smallford, Coney Heath Lane and Coney Heath High Street, the longabout has not only been dangerous but in some cases deadly. Motorcyclist Neil Christian was killed on the road in March 2011 after his bike was struck by a Ford Fiesta which pulled out of the junction. The longabout falls within a 50 mph zone, but Councillor Brazier said in the wake of the fatality that it was merely used as a chicane and that it's not unusual for drivers to pass through the junction at speeds up to 80 mph. Prior to Mr. Christian's death, Hertfordshire Highways told Councillor Brazier improvements were not a priority due to the lack of fatalities. In 2007, the junction was 143rd down the list of hazardous sites, despite numerous incidents, including a seven-car smash when a woman veered off the road in 2014, a motorcyclist who suffered a broken leg after hitting a car in 2013, and two people being taken to hospital after a car was pushed onto the central reservation in 2012. In 2011, Herts County Council said a safety scheme was planned for the A414 longabout, which included putting traffic signals in at the junction with Smallford Lane. This would help slow vehicles down and create gaps in the traffic to make it easier to access the A414 from Smallford Lane and Coney Heath. The work was scheduled to take place in spring 2012, but nothing happened. In 2014, the Coney Heath longabout was finally classified as a hazardous site after there were 20 injurious accidents reported between 2011 to 2013, more than three times the qualifying threshold of six. A County Council report recommended a change to the road layout by putting traffic lights in the centre of the junction where the High Street meets the A414 and a triangle island in the High Street arm of the junction. Temporary lights were trialled in March 2015 and found to be a viable solution as they would reduce the number of cars U-turning at the Coney Heath Lane end and make gaps in traffic more predictable for people turning into the road. But in March 2017, residents were told Herts County Council did not have money for the safety improvements, although would prioritise and address the issue for the financial year 2019 to 2020. Over the years, Councillor Brazier has raised the issue with the police, MPs and Herts Highways, and he has reported his frustrations in the pages of the Herts Advertiser. He said this week, "My endeavours have always come up against costs, opposition to slowing the traffic flowing between the Hatfield and London Coney roundabouts. So imagine my delight when through local residents' doors came a letter." The letter he is referring to said, "The junction of the A414 North Orbital Road and High Street Coney Heath is to have traffic signals installed. Improvements are to be made to the eastbound approach of the longabout. Work is programmed to commence August 17, 2020 for 11 weeks. Councillor Brazier said, "We will have to wait until the completion of the works to monitor if there is any improvement in traffic behaviour. I feel that anything that slows the A414 traffic down and makes it easier for residents to enter and exit Coney Heath without risk is going to be an enhancement to everybody's lives. I would also like to thank local residents, our county councillors and Coney Heath Parish Council who supported me over many years." A spokesperson for Herts County Council said, "This was a particularly difficult scheme to design, and we had to go through a number of iterations so we could provide the maximum benefit for pedestrians, cyclists, horse users, as well as the local residents. From August the 17th until October the 22nd, there will be a single lane in both directions, and High Street, Coney Heath, will be closed at its junction with the A414. Some overnight closures will occur throughout October. Diversion signage will be in place."
Hello, Steve here. My first story is, 20's Plenty, says new speed reduction group. A new campaign group is calling for urgent action to reduce the speed limit in many St. Albans roads in a bid to make them safer for all users. Representatives from St. Albans Friends of the Earth, St. Albans Cycle Campaign, St. Albans Build Back Better, and Sustainable St. Albans have joined forces to call for lower speed limits under the umbrella group 20's Plenty for St. Albans District. Amanda Yoroth from the group said, "The government wants us to cycle more, but one of the main reasons that we give for not cycling is because we feel the roads are too dangerous. During lockdown, St. Albans and neighbouring communities saw reduced levels of traffic, which led to quieter, less polluted, safer and friendlier streets. People old and young who hadn't felt confident to take to our streets before, started walking and cycling. Lowering speed limits to 20 miles an hour reduces the risk of accidents, and means we're less likely to be badly hurt if we do have an accident. Yet Harts County Council thinks that speeding cars should be setting speed limits. It makes no sense. Until September 16th, the County Council is consulting on a revised speed management strategy, which will provide the framework for evaluating all proposed changes to speed limits, including those to introduce new 20 miles an hour zones. This strategy would review all limit change proposals based on the existing speed of traffic. Local people showed that they are happy to walk, cycle, and chat on our streets if they feel safe, said Colin Hodges of 20's Plenty for St Albans District. We believe that the Hertfordshire Speed Management Strategy should give priority to road safety, promotion of more active travel, and the environment. Despite the growth of 20 miles an hour zones elsewhere in the UK, there are no town-wide 20 miles an hour zones in Hertfordshire. We hope that the Harts County Council will recognise that times have changed and take this opportunity to make our roads more accessible for children, the elderly and other vulnerable groups.
Stansted Link. A new transport link between Stansted Airport and parts of Hertfordshire is being mooted in response to pandemic job and travel cuts. The proposed express bus or coach route would run from the airport via Hertford, Welwyn, Hatfield, Potter's Bar, London Coney, Brickett Wood, and through to Watford. Currently, a train journey to Stansted from the St Albans district can take up to 3 hours and involve an expensive mix of train and tube travel. It is being suggested by the Potter's Bar and St Albans Transport User Group, in brackets PBSAUG, and spokesman Paul Spelsini said further proposed rail reductions, the new A102 Haddon Bypass, and the pandemic mean that a new link from Central Harts is needed more than ever to provide a more direct journey to Stansted Airport to boost the badly hit travel industry, which has many local air users. HCC's proposed Mass Rapid Transport, in brackets MRT, scheme would not serve the airport and undermine the viability of existing bus services. Harts County Council's strategy for the A414 and parallel routes was adopted in 2019 and forms a strategic east-west transport corridor across the southern part of the county, linking into Harlow and Essex in the east. The corridor is critical to supporting current and future travel in and around Harts, but already experiences significant traffic congestion and poor journey time reliability. A mass rapid transit system forms part of the strategy, and although substantial technical studies have taken place, at this stage the final form and routes for the MRT are yet to be determined. Derek Ashley, County Council Cabinet Member for Growth, Infrastructure, Planning and the Economy, said, "Although these proposals are at an early stage, we're excited about this scheme and the huge difference that it can make to how people get about the county. Building a safe, reliable and modern passenger transport system will allow us to support the needs and new ways of working for our communities and businesses. We want to harness the most modern travel technology to provide our residents with a cost-effective, reliable and sustainable transport system. There's a long way to go, but the mass rapid transit scheme that we're proposing will provide a practical alternative to the car for people wanting to travel between some of Hart's biggest towns."
Hospital Trust defends study as campaigners brand it limited and superficial. Campaigners for a new hospital central to St Albans, Watford and Decorum have slammed a site feasibility study as limited and inadequate. The study was submitted to West Hertfordshire Hospitals NHS Trust, WHHT, on August the 21st, suggesting potential sites for a new hospital, including King's Langley, Eastern Hemel Hempstead, Chiswell Green, Radlett Airfield, and Watford Riverwell. However, members of the New Hospitals Campaign, NHC, believe the study was a box-ticking exercise designed to favour the NHS Trust's previously stated preferred option to renovate the existing hospital site at Watford General instead of building a new hospital. A statement from campaigners said, "This was a fundamentally misconceived study from the start. As we have mentioned to the Trust, there should have been a full review of all available sites, not a small selection hand-picked by the Trust. The four new sites, not including Watford General or Watford Riverwell, were derived from a study of 17 sites conducted nearly 5 years ago and commissioned by the Harts Valley Clinical Commissioning Group when there was briefly an open mind on the issue of location. The present superficial and limited approach was irresponsible and indicates that this exercise was simply designed to support the Trust's fixation with hanging on to their dysfunctional and inaccessible site at West Watford. The group has long argued that the Watford General site in Vicarage Road is unfit for purpose and poorly located, and that centering services there would disadvantage patients in other areas. WHHT Deputy Chief Executive Helen Brown told the Harts Ad, "Independent experts have been engaged to carry out feasibility studies on numerous site options over several years, and their findings are in the public domain. We are satisfied that all sites that merited a review were considered, and we were also content that the level of research was appropriate for this stage of the process. Options that are shortlisted will be reviewed in more depth later this year. The age and condition of our estate is, overall, very poor, and this has had a significant impact on our ability to deliver high-quality care to patients. This is why we must consider options that deliver improvements to patients quickly and mitigate the risk of a serious infrastructure failure. We hope that all campaigners and interested parties, whatever their views are, understand how important and urgent it is to improve our facilities in the shortest time possible. With every passing cold and wet winter and hot summer, our estate becomes even more challenging to maintain and less likely to support a positive experience for our patients and staff. The sites designated by the Trust for consideration in the feasibility study are land east of the A41, WD48EE, a greenfield site, not owned by the Trust, the eastern side of Hemel Hempstead, South Gorhambury Estate, also a greenfield site. Also under consideration is land off Junction 21, Chiswell Green, the former Radlett Airfield and Watford Riverwell, and the existing Watford General Hospital, which are both owned by the Trust. Helen Brown continued, "Our current buildings make it difficult to provide the very best care for every patient every day. Our clinical teams are supporting the detailed planning required to plan new facilities and are working hard to make the most of all the opportunities this will give us to improve care. After many years of planning, the Trust is very keen to bring about positive change and transform its buildings. We believe that this current funding opportunity gives us a real chance to secure much-needed and long-awaited investment. We are prepared to pull out all the stops to make the most of this once-in-a-generation opportunity for our patients and for our staff. While the timeline is challenging, there has been a great deal of serious thought and planning over a long time now on new buildings and new models of care, and the overwhelming view from the staff is that they want to see this talk become a reality. The thought of any kind of delay is much more of a concern than having to work hard and at pace for the benefit of all the communities we serve."
Is two-tier system a relic, or does it help ensure real democratic voice? The leader of Hertfordshire County Council has called the two-tier local government system a bit of historical relic, and advocated for them to be scrapped across the UK. And on Friday, Councillor David Williams, who is also chairman of the County Councils Network, the CCN, published a compelling financial case through the CCN for the creation of single county unitary councils. The report, commissioned by the CCN, which is dominated by mainly Conservative councils including Hertfordshire, estimates £2.94 billion could be saved over 5 years nationally and will create a levelling up of services if boroughs and districts are scrapped. Consultants PwC have already been asked by Harts leader Councillor Williams in November 2019 to confirm if there was a financial case to abolish borough and districts and create a mega authority. but the leaders of the 10 district and borough councils, who have since commissioned their own consultants to explore alternative proposals, have rejected this proposal and reacted negatively to being told 9 months after PwC was hired. Leader of Stevenage Borough Council, Councillor Sharon Taylor, Labour, told the BBC on Friday that unitary plans are not devolution but centralisation and would make the 1.3 million people in Hearts democratically worse off with less reactive representation. She added, "That real democratic voice that people have at a local level is really important to them." However, Councillor Williams said, "Unitary counties won't lead to a democratic deficit. Rather, as evidenced by authorities that have already made this journey, they have the potential to bring services closer to residents, developing new ways for residents to engage and shape service provision more effectively and enhance local democratic participation with empowered town and parish councils." The CCN report comes ahead of the publication of the government's Devolution and Local Recovery White Paper, which is expected to advocate for the abolishment of boroughs and districts.
Schools talk outbreak policy and masks ahead of return. Schools in Hertfordshire have been quizzed on what their responses will be to localised outbreaks of coronavirus, the wearing of masks, and the morning school run ahead of the planned September return. Hertfordshire County Council says it is working closely with schools, Public Health England, and central government guidelines to ensure a safe return. For those pupils who use public transport to get to and from school, the County Council says it has issued clear advice on the wearing of facial coverings. For school children over the age of 11 who use public transport, the wearing of masks will be mandatory, unless they are medically exempt. Schools have been briefed to ensure pupils wear, remove, and dispose of those masks safely and properly. There are also plans to provide an additional 70 buses and coaches for the school run, to greatly increase the capacity on both public and educational-only bus routes. The County Council is also encouraging walking and cycling rather than taking a car, as it allows for more opportunities to socially distance. Schools in our area have also shared what their response would be should there be a coronavirus outbreak within the school or local area ahead of their planned September return. If there was an outbreak, two or more confirmed cases of the virus, within a school, any decision to close a school would rely on advice from the County Council, Public Health England and Central Government. Similarly, if there were two or more confirmed cases of the virus within a bubble, typically divided into year groups, then the entirety of that bubble may have to self-isolate. Schools have also had to fill out risk assessment forms on the organisation or grouping, including how bubbles and staffing are grouped to support a consistent and safe return. Tanya Rawl, Head of School Standards and Accountability at HCC, said, "Bubbles are a little bit bigger now in some schools compared to last term. Within bubbles, you have to socially distance less because you have a consistent group of people. The government has been really clear that schools will be the last things that would shut if there was a spike. We are working closely with public health colleagues to make sure we have sufficient support for schools and are developing systems should there be an outbreak or spike in the area."
Hello, I'm Deborah, and my first article is entitled "No Formal Procedures Against Parents Who Don't Send Kids Back to School." Parents and carers who have doubts over sending their kids back to school this September may be relieved to hear Hearts County Council will not seek formal procedures against those who refuse to return. Although government guidance dictates attendance at schools is now mandatory for pupils, the County Council has confirmed it is not proposing to take punitive action against parents who refuse to send their children back to school. Instead, HCC says it will work to encourage and provide support to those parents and carers who have lingering concerns about the return to school. Tanya Rawl, Head of School Standards and Accountability at HCC, said, it is a really key and important factor to get these children back into school. But we, the County Council, don't want to take any punitive action at this stage. We recognise that there is still a lot of concern and anxiety out there. I'm confident that our head teachers, who have been doing this since before Easter, are on top of this and understand the risk factors. They've been really good in adapting and developing their systems and processes following updates in government guidance. I'm confident they've got this well and truly on track. Councillor Terry Duris, HCC's Executive Member for Education, added, "I think it is so important that we see children getting back to school and getting back to education, because they have missed out. We cannot afford, for the benefit of the children we cherish, for them not to have a continuing education. That is best delivered in schools. It's so important that they do get back into school in terms of education, but also in terms of social interaction. I think the Prime Minister made a very eloquent plea for children to get back into school, because they only have one opportunity to learn in one year group, and we can't afford for them to miss that opportunity." Earlier this week, Prime Minister Boris Johnson encouraged parents to prepare children for a September return to school. "Nothing will have a greater effect on the life chances of our children than returning to school."
Hello, this is Jane Wilson. My first article today is titled "Girls Arrested After Car Chase." A collision took place in St Albans at the weekend after police pursued a stolen car driven by two teenage girls. At around 3:40 a.m. on Sunday, August the 30th, police attempted to stop a Nissan Juke, which failed to stop and collided with a Mercedes GLA on Hatfield Road, St Albans. The Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire and Harts Road Policing Unit were assisted by St Albans Police, Harts Fire and Rescue Service, the East of England Ambulance Service and the Beds, Cambridgeshire and Hertfordshire Police Dog Unit. A 16-year-old girl from Wheatamstead and a 15-year-old girl from St Albans who were inside the Duke were arrested on suspicion of theft of a motor vehicle. One of the girls was taken to Lister Hospital in Stevenage with minor injuries. Both cars were seriously damaged in the crash and a police cordon was put up in the area while emergency services dealt with the incident.
Hello, my name's Christine Stanley and my first item is entitled "New Safety Measures on the Buses as Students Return to School Draws Nearer." Officials from bus operator Arriva have released more details on how they intend to keep school children who use the bus safe as preparations for the return to school ramp up. From September the 1st, some Arriva services will be reserved for school, sixth form and college pupils, and these will be marked clearly with a letter S, that's S for sugar, before their normal route number. Pupils from any year group and any school can travel on these buses. Arriva buses also undergo enhanced touchpoint cleaning daily, and bus windows will be kept open where possible. Contactless payments or tickets are recommended, as cash payments will only be accepted in exceptional circumstances, and bus drivers will not be providing change. Simon Finney, Arriva's area manager director, said, "If you need to travel on the same bus as pupils from another school, then please sit with others from your own school, ideally from your own year group. Where possible, we're asking you to maintain social distancing, although capacity on these buses will be increased, allowing students to sit next to each other and standing if necessary. We recommend that all pupils over the age of 11 wear a face covering, but exemptions apply. Pupils should also carry hand sanitizer with them and use it before getting on and off the bus wherever possible." Hertfordshire County Council has said it has plans to provide an additional 70 buses and coaches for the school run that will increase capacity on both public and educational-only bus routes. A spokeswoman for the Hertfordshire County Council added, We've been in constant communication with commercial bus providers, and Arriva are providing a number of duplicate buses. They have supplied us with timetables which will be in operation from September the 1st, and these will be updated on websites. That's for buses Arriva and Interlink services, as soon as the final list is confirmed this week. Our strategy has been built around enhancing capacity on routes to ensure children who want to use a bus to travel to and from school can do so. We will be monitoring from day one where extra vehicles may be needed in addition to the 70 extra vehicles we are already providing. We are also encouraging active travel, such as walking and cycling where possible, to minimise congestion. And there's a photograph of the blue Arriva bus waiting at the bus stop.
Proposed parking changes not welcome in all streets. Consultation into a major review of parking provision across a large section of St Albans has prompted angry reactions from some sections of the community. The scheme affects the so-called ladder roads, the Marshalswick South Ward, north of Sandpit Lane, and the original Zone P areas, and comes in the wake of an informal consultation back in February. It proposes reducing the number of controlled parking zones, CPZs, from 4 to 3, including creating a new zone LR for the ladder roads, and reducing shared-use parking designed for resident permit holders and pay-by-phone parking. The new zone MS for Marshalswick South will mostly be a shared-use parking zone, with restrictions from 11am to 1pm on Mondays to Fridays. It also recommends increasing the cost of parking day rates to £5.40, in line with the city's short-stay commuter car parks. But Jill Owen of Charmouth Road believes the plans are unfair on some residents. Although the single yellow lines proposed will allow better and safer traffic flow and are to be welcomed, I do question the proposal when it comes to pay parking. It seems the burden of commuter parking is not being equally spread among similar streets, as would be fair and reasonable. It is proposed that some roads are to lose over half their on-street parking provision to yellow lines and have to take commuter parking in all the remaining spaces. This seems grossly unfair and arbitrary when other roads which have a similar level of driveway parking get 100% of their spaces for residents only and no loss of spaces to yellow lines. All streets should have a similar amount of available resident parking. Under the current proposal, commuters are being foisted on just a few roads rather than spread evenly across the area. This scheme massively disadvantages some roads, leaving them with insufficient capacity for their residents. Marshalswick South Conservative councillor Richard Curtoys said, "Despite promises made by Councillor White, the portfolio holder for parking, prior to the 2019 local elections, the impact of the Clarence CPZ on residents in Marshalswick South has been severe. When a resident asked a local Lib Dem councillor if this could be reviewed and revised, she stated that it was illegal to do so, whereas the SADC legal department stated this was possible, only the will was required. It's perfectly understandable that residents without off-street parking in terraced houses should be able to park near their properties and that commuter parking should be discouraged at these locations. However, the wide roads in Clarence Ward, where residents have ample off-street parking, should not be included in a CPZ, as this has the effect of displacing parking to Lancaster Road, Battlefield Road, Charmouth Road, Gurney Court Road and Homewood Road, making residents' lives very difficult due to commuter parking and consequent congestion. All it takes is a little imagination and creativity, something that is clearly lacking in the current administration. I have formally objected to the proposal supporting residents, whilst my fellow Lib Dem councillors on Marshalswick South have stayed silent. Council leader, Councillor Chris White, explained that the process of reviewing the proposals was ongoing, so no final decision had been made. The issue, of course, is that the consultation is still open and the people need to send in their concerns. Officials will respond and then send final recommendations to ward councillors. I then sign off in the light of the recommendations and the ward councillors' comments. Consultation on the proposal is open until Friday, September the 11th. To have your say, email parkingrestrictions@stalbans.gov.uk or write to Ladder Roads Consultation 2020, Parking Development, St Albans City and District Council, St Peter Street, St Albans, AL1 3JE.
Train fares could go up next January despite drop in number of passengers. Train fares could rise by 1.6% in 2021 in line with inflation. From January, yearly travel tickets to London are estimated to increase by £81.22 from Royston, £63.42 from Stevenage, £59.39 from St Albans and £49.60 from Welwyn Garden City. This is significantly less than the 2020 increase in Harts of 2.7% when the retail price index figures were announced for July, which meant an increase in fares of over £100. However, The Times is reporting that inflation rises could be delayed till March or scrapped altogether, and said ministers have refused to commit to the rise. They told the national newspaper the government is considering the rail fares package for January and will provide an update in due course. Many rail groups argue the lower inflation rate, called the Consumer Price Index, or CPI, should have been used, as it would have meant a lower fare increase. In July, CPI rose by 1% from 0.6% in June. Anthony Smith, chief executive of the independent watchdog Transport Focus, said last week, "People's feelings about travel and the way they use public transport have changed. While the rail leisure travel may bounce back, our research tells us almost 2 in 3 former rail commuters expect to work from home more. So we will probably now travel less for work, both commuting and on business. The government must go above and beyond a fares freeze and get train companies to offer a combination of cut price deals, carnet-style bundles, flexible season tickets for commuters, and better value-for-money fares across the board." A review into rail travel, putting the commuter at the heart of decision-making, has been promised to deliver a white paper, that's a government policy document, reforming travel. However, Keith Williams, independent chair of the Rail Review, has yet to release his full report. Mr. Williams said on July 16th that he is looking at simplifying fares and ticketing. "To create a modern, customer-focused railway, we must tackle fares reform," he said. "The structure hasn't been substantially updated since 1995 and is holding back innovation and customer-focused improvements across the network."
Tree crashes down to the ground in the aftermath of a storm. The devastation was caused when a 100-foot tree standing on land behind properties in St Edmunds Walk on St Albans Highfield Estate crashed to the ground at approximately 10:10 a.m. on Tuesday, August the 25th. It fell onto the back thirds of three neighbouring properties, destroying fences and sheds in the process. One of the residents, who asked not to be named, said, "My neighbour in the past has complained about the trees on this land to the council, the housing association and Highfield Park, but no one would take responsibility for them. They were very overgrown and the top part of the one that fell down was dead at the top. Currently, all three properties are not secure and we're very concerned about our safety. None of us slept on Wednesday due to the high winds and worrying that the other overgrown trees would also fall onto our properties. There are at least 6 overgrown trees on this land near to our properties, which were originally part of the Hill End Hospital site. I've lived at my property for 11 years, my neighbours for over 20 years, and no maintenance has ever been carried out on these trees. We're at a loss as to what to do next, as no one's listening or helping us. Her daughter, Debbie Thane, said, "Nobody has maintained these for years, and it's now got to the stage that my 81-year-old mum is fearing for her life. She was in real shock this week when the storm caused one of them to crash into her garden. My sister complained about these trees 2 years ago, but nothing's been done. St Albans District Council discovered that the land is actually owned by PA Housing Association." And a spokesperson for the company said, "On the afternoon of Friday the 28th of August, a resident at St Edmund's Walk contacted PA Housing to inform us that a tree had fallen into their garden, causing damage to their fencing and sheds, as well as to the fencing of two neighbouring properties. This was the first notification we received about the fallen tree. A tree company attended St Edmund's Walk on Saturday the 29th of August to assess the damage, and we are now in the process of having the fallen tree removed. We've arranged for a member of the PA housing team to visit the residents." And there's a photograph of an enormous tree with a huge thick trunk just fallen right in the back of somebody's garden. You can't see the garden at all. The fence is down. You just can't see any of the garden. It's an enormous tree. A lot of damage done.
MPs Commons debate on rail freight depot. St Albans MP Daisy Cooper has taken her fight against the Park Street rail freight depot to the House of Commons. She argued in the chamber how there were compelling reasons why the government should scrap plans for a strategic rail freight interchange, SRFI, on the site of the former Radlett Aerodrome. She secured the Commons debate on the scheme after St Albans District Council was held hostage and forced to abandon its own plans to build housing on the site. She has vowed to fight the development to the bitter end. Daisy told the House, "If it goes ahead, what this means is that 3.5 million square metres of greenbelt, the size of 490 football pitches, will be converted into a massive rail and lorry park with warehouses, lorries, container storage, HGV parking and so on. It will bring thousands of heavy goods vehicles per day and bring huge disruption to the surrounding roads and commuter rail links. A freight terminal in this location has always been a bad idea, but there are also new and compelling reasons why it should be reviewed and why the plans for the rail freight terminal should be scrapped." She pointed out that it is just not possible to include a massive rail interchange the size of 490 football pitches and meet the government's target to build more than 14,000 homes over the next 16 years in the St Albans area, while also protecting the greenbelt. Daisy also highlighted the disruption to rail commuters caused by the need to enlarge tunnels at Elstree and near Kentish Town, as well as the impact on roads and local village communities. She called on the government to justify the need for the Park Street SFRI in the light of the government's new post-Brexit free ports policy, with the announcement expected by the end of this year of up to 10 free ports to begin operations in 2021. She asked for details of any impact assessment carried out by the government on the London Gateway container terminal, which has opened on the Thames since the Park Street depot was first proposed, and has since led to plans for an SRFI site at Howbury Park near Dartford to be dropped.
Vulnerable man asked for rent already being paid by benefits. A vulnerable man is calling for changes in the way a housing association operates after being pressured for rent that is already being paid. Over several years, Hightown Housing Association has written numerous letters to resident Danny Smith demanding arrears on his Waverley Lodge flat. He is in receipt of full housing benefit due to his disability, which means he cannot work. Not only that, but his full rent is paid directly to Hightown. The situation began causing him so much stress this year that he eventually sought help from the Citizens Advice Bureau. He said, I've been asked several times to pay rent, which is already being paid in full, directly to my landlord, because they say I am in rent arrears. I'm not behind on my rent at all. It's just that anybody on housing benefit has their rent paid in arrears, as that is how the district council issue it. It really made me panic. It has made my anxiety so much worse, and I'm so grateful to St Albans Citizens Advice Bureau for helping me. The 45-year-old said that he knows that many people who rely on housing benefit to cover or help pay their rental cost are not as vocal as he is, and may not feel able to stand up to Hightown's demands. He said that the association's housing officers are monitored on their rent account activity, and some have suggested that he just pay a few pounds a week to get on top of the arrears. He said that people on full state benefit or in low-income jobs simply cannot be making up for what is essentially just a procedural issue with the timing of council payment to landlords and the way the tenancies stipulate rent should be paid in advance. A caseworker from the Citizens Advice Bureau has written to Hightown to make sure they are aware of the situation in the hope that it will not happen again. A spokesperson for Hightown said, "Hightown supports tenants to help them meet the terms of their tenancy agreement, which includes paying their rent in advance. We have a dedicated financial inclusion service that helps people understand their entitlement to benefits and avoid building up debts, which they may later find it difficult to clear. We can confirm that we have sent one letter to Mr. Smith about his account in the last year, and we are sorry if this has worried him. He has not contacted us directly to discuss it. We will try to contact Mr. Smith to discuss his concerns and offer him any appropriate support."
Here is a list of deaths as published in the Hertfordshire Advertiser. Doreen Patricia Ivory, aged 83. Marjorie Byers. On a personal note, I was also saddened to read of the death of Barry Cashin back in July. I know he wasn't necessarily a favourite of Hearts Advertiser readers, but for me he often voiced what people thought but were afraid to say. At his best, for me, his writing was up there with Victor Lewis Smith in the Evening Standard and the late Clive James in the Observer. Witty and written with perfect syntax and grammar. Barry, I thank you. Now a little more music from Gothby, followed by John reading the national radio listings.
For a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights. A change of month and a change of season. Perhaps. Is it ever the end of summer until the last night of the proms? And in spite of all the problems, you will have a nightly prom to look forward to in this week's highlights. Starting off then with Saturday, September 5th. An Agatha Christie mystery with Miss Marple, Sleeping Murder, is at 4 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. A new series of Political Thinking with Nick Robinson starts at 5:30 p.m. on Radio 4. Cowan's Classics on Classic FM at 7 p.m. includes music by Cezanne and Wagner. Archive on 4, Radio 4 at 8 p.m. tells how, after the destruction of the Spitfire factory in Southampton in 1940, plane continued to be made. And Grounded with Louis Theroux continues at 10:15 p.m. on Radio 4. This week, his companion is Gail Porter. Sunday, September 6th, and the drama on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. is Half a Yellow Sun by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. It's a powerful and compassionate depiction of the Biafra War of the 1960s. There's an extra prom on Radio 3 at 5:30 p.m. featuring music for cello performed by Sheku and Izata Kanamason. It's followed at 6:45 p.m. by Gabriel Prokofiev, My Family and Russia. Sunday night is Music Night at 7pm on Radio 2, when the BBC Big Band celebrates Woody Herman. On to programmes then that are serialised at the same time on the same channel Monday to Friday, starting from Monday, September 7th. And don't forget the proms, as mentioned. You'll be able to listen to a prom every evening at 7:30pm on Radio 3. As ever, they bring an eclectic mix of concerts chosen from the last decade, as well as some performed live, but without an audience, in the Royal Albert Hall. So, on to those programmes serialised Monday to Friday. The Book of the Week on Radio 4 at 9:45am and repeated at 12:30 midnight is at Ramble Book by Adam Buxton. He tells of life with his father in his final months after a diagnosis of cancer. The 15-minute drama at 10:45am on Radio 4 and repeated at 7:45pm is Prostrate by Martin Jameson. It tells of a chance encounter between two sufferers with prostate cancer after an effect on each other's lives. The composer of the week continues to be Beethoven. This week it looks at his life between 1813 and 1815 and can be heard all week on Radio 3 at noon. The Lying Life of Adults by Elana Ferrante continues with the last week just after midday on Radio 4. It's repeated at 10:45 each evening. At 1:45pm on Radio 4, Joe Queenan's exploration of American history from the Mayflower to the Moon and back again continues. And there's an omnibus edition on Friday at 9pm. Again, same time, Monday to Friday, on same radio station, a dramatisation of H.G. Wells' Kipps is at 3pm on Radio 4 Extra. At 8pm on Radio 4 Extra, there's a Somerset Maugham short story, followed at 8:30 by The Great Impersonation. The mystery novel by E. Philip Oppenheim is also dramatised. And the Classic FM concert, 8pm on Classic FM, introduced by John Suchet, this week celebrates the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra. An interesting afternoon's listening is on offer for Monday, September 7th, starting at 2:45pm on Radio 4. The Museum of Lost Objects, followed at 3pm by Brain of Britain, and at 3:30pm the food programme, tell how free food was provided during the lockdown. Then, cup of tea in hand, you can join Jack Whitehall at 4pm for my dream dinner party. The radio archive provides Roger Moore, Frankie Howard and Lauren Bacall as his guests. The Museum of Curiosity returns to Radio 4 at 6:30pm with host John Lloyd. The Blues Show with Kerris Matthews is at 9pm on Radio 2. Tuesday, September 8th has a lunchtime concert on Radio 3 at 1pm with violin sonatas by Beethoven and Prokofiev's Five Melodies. Shortcuts is at 3pm on Radio 4 when Josie Long presents short and unusual documentaries. Followed at 3:30pm by Costing the Earth, which looks at the prospect of cities without cars. The Great Life this week is Kenneth Williams. Matthew Paris is joined by Tom Allen at 4:30pm on Radio 4 to look at the life of the comic actor. The Jazz Show with Jamie Cullen is at 9pm on Radio 2. At the same time on Radio 4, Science Stories considers the legacy of Margaret Cavendish, the Restoration writer and thinker who fascinated the elite of the time, including Samuel Pepys. Comedy to the Fore on Wednesday, September 9th, starting at 4pm on Radio 4 Extra with Angela Barnes' Cold War Secrets, and continuing at 5pm with Claire in the Community. 5:30pm, Paul Sinner's General Knowledge reflects on people through history named Clive. Switch to Radio 4 at 6:30pm for Phil Ellis is Trying, a comedy about a struggling children's entertainer. And then back to Radio 4 Extra, 7pm for some vintage Hancock's Half Hour, 7:30pm Up the Garden Path with Imelda Staunton. Radio 4, 8pm, you can be grounded with Louis Theroux, who will be talking to Chris O'Dowd this week. And The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe, Radio 2, 9pm. Thursday, September 10th, has probably the best programme title of the week in the Crossing Continents series. It's 11am, Radio 4, The Trouble with Dutch Cows. It's reports on the Dutch farmers who were in uproar about a plan to reduce herds by half to enable the reduction of their toxic gas emissions. The welcome return of Ramblings is at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. Claire Balding is joined by comedian and writer Dom Jolly as they walk from Winchmore in Gloucestershire to a Roman villa. Radio 4 Extra at 4:45 p.m. for 15 minutes with David Attenborough, who investigates the possible existence of the Loch Ness Monster. Then at 5 p.m, The Missing Hancocks, a re-recording of a lost 1955 episode. You can enjoy a delightful 30 minutes at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4 when Between Ourselves with Marion Keyes continues with her reading her essay, Happy All the Time. Two old favourites are on Radio 4 Extra at 7 p.m. with Beyond Our Ken, and at 7:30 p.m, Yes, Minister. And The Country Show with Bob Harris is on Radio 2 at 9 p.m. A more serious end to the week for Friday, September 11th on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. with Austerity Audit in the first of 9 programmes the decade of austerity instigated by George Osborne is examined. The drama at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4 is Death Knock. A black teenager is found stabbed to death and a reporter has cause to examine the realities of his past. Short Works from Fact to Fiction at 3:45 on Radio 4 reflects on a topical event, and at 4 p.m. Last Word celebrate the lives of notable people, and at 4:30 p.m. Tim Harford's More or Less looks at the spin behind topical numbers and statistics. The News Quiz returns to Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. with Andy Zaltzman as host. And an evening of nostalgia can be heard on Radio 2. 7 p.m, Tony Blackburn's Golden Hour. 8 p.m, Gary Davis and guests bring you Sounds of the 80s. And then 10 p.m, Fern Cotton plays Sounds of the 90s. As ever, we hope you find some entertaining and interesting listening from this week's selection. And may I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week.
Now, Sarah Keeling, curator of St Albans Museum and Gallery, takes us on a tour of the building.
My name's Sarah Keeling. I'm curator here at St Albans Museum and Gallery, and I've been asked to give you a tour of the building during lockdown. So we're going to be exploring over the next few weeks all of the spaces here, but I'm starting in the entranceway, and it's really strange to be here in this quiet. Normally, I'd have the cafe to my right serving their lovely cakes and pastries, and I would have our welcome desk to the left with our front of house staff welcoming you to exhibitions, handing out maps, handing out information, selling you things in the shop. So it's a bit strange that it's so quiet. The building opened in the 1830s, and at that stage it would have been known as St Albans Courthouse. I know a lot of people locally still refer to this building as the Town Hall, and it was the Town Hall for a very long time, but its initial purpose, its primary purpose, was a courthouse. So if you'd stood here in the 1830s, where I am right now, I'd have had magistrates' offices, I'd have had clerks' offices, there'd have been spaces for the jury, people coming and going to hear what was going on in the court, members of the public coming to watch trials. You'd have also had the noise of the town outside because there were no doors on the front. It was only iron railings. So it would have been a very noisy space and very much felt like the bustle of the market came into the building. You'd have also had members of the Corporation of St Albans and the council coming to come upstairs to the assembly room where they used the space for their meetings. There's the mayor's parlour was upstairs, so there'd been people coming and going for that. And if you'd come back in an evening, you might have seen ladies in their beautiful fine gowns heading upstairs to the assembly room for a ball or a dinner or a concert. So it's always been quite a busy and changing space. It's always had a number of uses as a building, as we do now, being a museum and gallery and event space. The other thing about where I am standing right now is that if you'd been here not long before the museum and gallery took over, you wouldn't have been able to walk straight into the building. A lot of you will remember when this space was the tourist information or when it was a cafe and the building was blocked off. Now, one of the things that we've done is we've opened it back up so that the whole building feels like a whole building. And I can step through from the entrance hall and into our timeline gallery. This space with its terrazzo marble floor and its chandelier is a really beautiful space. And it's where we tell the story of St Albans right from its earliest Iron Age beginnings as the settlement of Valamian and right the way through up into the 21st century city it is today. This story gives you an outline of everything that's happened to bring St Albans to where it is today. It talks about the fact that where I'm standing right now is also the site of the first Battle of St Albans during the Wars of the Roses. It shows you mosaics and coins, tiles from the abbey before the monastery was dissolved. And then it brings you right through and shows the products of some of our local industries, including rider seeds and Belitos, who made tights. It also points you out into the wider world. So even though you can't come in and see us at the moment, I'm sure some of you who live in Wheathampstead may have been visiting Devil's Dyke, which is an Iron Age fortification. Or you might have been to see the ruins at Sopwell, which are the ruins of Sir Richard Lee's house, which he built after he was given the land of the abbey. So it's a space where you can really start to find out about St Albans, where you will always be able to see that grand sweep of history. And then in the rest of the building, we're able to tell more stories, either historical or modern, and also celebrate some of the artists, craftspeople, musicians and other wonderful creatives that exist in the city and district today. Over the next few weeks, I will, as I say, take you all around the buildings. I'll explain some of the galleries. I'll explain a little bit more about the history of the building and about the project that we did here to leave our own stamp on the building, to add the glazed links on the outside, to add our brand new gallery downstairs. But I hope that this has been a little bit of an introduction to this ever-changing building.
Now, another from our series, London Beyond Sight. This week, Zoe Wanamaker, the actress, talks about Bush House in London. This is one of the many fascinating items that can be found on the Vocalise London Beyond Sight website.
My name is Zoe Wanamaker and I'm an actress. I've chosen Bush House in the Old Witch as my iconic London building because it has a fantastic setting and also because it's the home of the BBC World Service. I've loved radio all my life. My mother was an actress and she had the radio on all the time when we were young. So I grew up with it, and now I have at least five radios in the house, all usually turned to Radio 4. When I'm on my own, I have the radio on at night too, and at 1 o'clock, when Radio 4 hands over to the World Service, you simply get a different perspective. You hear about places like Somalia that rarely feature at all during the day. Bush House stands at the end of Kingsway, a grand avenue that runs down from Holborn towards Fleet Street. As you walk down Southampton Road towards Holborn, you become aware that several of the buildings are massive six-story affairs of soft grey Portland stone. Their bottom floors are double height with big panels of stone ornamented with carved horizontal lines, and their top floors are set back beyond wrought iron balcony rails. Perhaps they were servants' quarters when these buildings were constructed more than 100 years ago. I'm particularly fond of the former Central St Martin School of Art and Design at a junction just north of High Holborn, with its distinctive leaded roof rising to a rounded cupola above the entrance. For me, it has a very definite personality, bound up with its history as an art school. The windows are varied and distinctive and remind me of the arts and crafts period and the work of Charles Rennie Mackintosh. Then you cross the busy thoroughfare of High Holborn. The road bends just a fraction, and suddenly Kingsway stretches ahead of you down towards the Thames. It's one of the broadest streets in London, a grand avenue 30 metres wide, lined on each side by tall plane trees. It was built in 1907 in the reign of King Edward VII and intended partly as a royal processional route. Until the 1950s, trolley buses used to rattle their way up from the Holborn underpass and trundle down the road, but these days it takes six lanes of traffic. And there at the end is Bush House facing you, framed by the plane trees. Its entrance portico is as tall as the treetops, its gabled roof rises above them. As you draw closer, it becomes clear that the building stands nine stories high, with most of the facade taken up by the huge entrance. Two massive fluted stone pillars rise 12 metres high to support a broad platform, on which two statues stand beneath a rounded roof. They are both men, and each holds a flaming torch and a shield. Between them is an altar embossed with a Celtic cross. These two figures represent Britain and America. Their shields are emblazoned with the British Lion and the American Eagle. The portico beneath them is about 4 metres deep and semicircular, with stone benches lining its curved walls. The stone roof is carved into a decorative waffle shape, and two massive dark wood doors stand open at the back, each with a heavy brass lion's head door knocker. Inscribed above the door is the legend, "Dedicated to the friendship of the English-speaking peoples." It's a resounding dedication and could have been made for the BBC World Service, but it wasn't. Bush House was originally conceived as a luxurious international trade centre where buyers from all over the world could meet and purchase goods under one roof. It was the vision of a rich American industrialist called Irving T. Bush, no relation to George. In 1919, he employed fellow American Harvey Wiley Corbett as his architect. Corbett had recently built the 30-story Bush Tower in New York and was becoming known as an architect who thought on a grand scale and had a preference for skyscrapers. The London County Council wasn't having any of that. It had strict planning rules. So Corbett had to make an impression in another way. And he did it with the grandeur of the entrance and the sheer mass of Bush House. Because of the building I'm talking about, with the imposing entrance, is only one of five, the whole complex spans the Aldwych and the Strand, with five enormous blocks constructed of Portland stone, connected by loggias and bridges. When the project was finally finished in 1935, it was declared the most expensive building in the world, having cost $10 million. Construction was at an early stage when, in 1921, financial depression struck. It meant most of the blocks had to be turned into conventional offices. It was too late to modify the centre block, though, and it stands as a testament to one man's ambitious dream. Irving T. Bush was over 70 by the time the BBC moved into Bush House during the Second World War. He must have been pleased that his dream of international cooperation was realised there, though not in the way he imagined. Ever since 1940, journalists and programme makers from many countries have been working at Bush House, doing their bit to contribute to international understanding and earning a worldwide reputation for their programmes. I think it's a shame that this summer the BBC will finally leave Bush House. But the building remains, still proud, still dominating its surroundings. And why not? After all, it has a history to be proud of.
More music now, and here's the full-length version of Sentimental Blues by Gothby. I've been enjoying the London Beyond Sight audio descriptions of significant London buildings, so I've delved into the American version based in New York City. Here, Nancy Plurger, president of the Manhattan Chamber of Commerce, describes the Chrysler Building, often cited as the most beautiful Art Deco skyscraper in New York.
Hello, I'm Nancy Plurger, president of the Manhattan Chamber of Commerce. One of my favorite buildings in New York is the Chrysler Building. I love its architecture, its design, the way the top of it is lit at night. I just think it's stellar, and I'm happy to describe it for you. The Chrysler Building is on 42nd Street between Lexington and 3rd Avenues. It's a New York icon for tourists and for city residents. Everyone knows its name, and the top of the building is instantly recognizable by all. You can't mistake it for any other building. Before I describe it, there's some interesting history about it you should know. Today, the Chrysler Building is not the tallest skyscraper in New York. It's tied for third. But once upon a time, it was the tallest for 11 months. That was in 1930. The man who built it, car manufacturer Walter Chrysler, wanted his company headquarters to be not only dramatic, but also taller than the tallest structure in the world, which at the time was the Eiffel Tower. But he knew that a business rival of his was building a skyscraper on Wall Street, the Bank of Manhattan building, and it looked like the bank would be the tallest. So Chrysler had his architect secretly build a 185-foot tall spire inside the upper floors of his building. A week after the Wall Street building was done, Chrysler's builders erected the spire, putting the Chrysler building taller than the bank by 172 feet. 11 months later, in 1931, the Empire State Building was finished, and that put an end to Chrysler's status as number one. The Chrysler Building is 77 stories high, and its style is called Art Deco. Art Deco is a term applied to art and architecture between the two world wars. Art Deco buildings were sleek and dramatic and embraced the future. The simplest way to describe the shape of the Chrysler Building is to say that it looks like a rocket on a launch pad. And remember, this was in 1930, when space travel was still in the realm of science fiction. The building's exterior is covered by white brick with dark gray brickwork used as horizontal decoration to enhance the windows. Long columns of windows rise the full height of the building, each outlined by a black frame. But like a rocket, the building is not the same height from the ground level to its top. It gradually narrows thanks to a series of setbacks. A setback is when some floors are recessed or set back from the facade of the ground level. So because of the setbacks, the building becomes gradually narrower and recedes gracefully from the street as it rises higher and higher. These setbacks are punctuated by decorative features unique to the Chrysler Building based on Chrysler automobiles of the time. So, for instance, at the 30th floor setback, two shiny stainless steel ornaments protrude from the corners. Some people think they're radiator caps. Others think they look like hubcaps with wings on them. Then higher at the 60th floor setback, stainless steel eagles jut out from the corners of the building. These are replicas of the 1929 Chrysler hood ornaments. The eagles are similar to gargoyles on a Gothic cathedral, fierce figures meant to protect the building from evil. But you can barely see these stainless steel features from the street. What everyone can see and immediately recognize is the tower or crown made up of the top 7 floors of the building. Some say it's modeled on a Chrysler's radiator grille. Each of the tower's 4 sides is composed of a series of concentric arches mounted one above the other, each one a bit smaller than the one below it. Across each arch is a pattern of triangles alternating with triangular windows. In effect, it's as if the tower is radiating energy like a sunburst. And what makes the whole tower so dramatic is that it's covered with stainless steel, so it shines in the daylight. And at night, the windows are lit, making it glow like a jewel, to me, a tall, pointed diamond. But you don't have to just take my word about the beauty of this building. In 2007, the American Institute of Architects ranked it 9th on the list of America's favorite architecture. And some people think the building's Art Deco interior is even more magnificent than its exterior, with its Art Deco designs and its ceiling paintings by Edward Trumbull. As you may have guessed by now, the Chrysler Building has been officially designated a New York City landmark. Souvenir shops all over New York sell models of it, so if you pick one up, you can feel its design.
Now let's have a look at events and birth dates in the past that happened in this upcoming week. On the 6th of September 1799, John Dalton, English physicist and chemist who developed the atomic theory of matter, was born in Eaglesfield near Cockermouth in Cumbria. John Dalton gained much scientific knowledge from John Gough, a blind philosopher who was gifted in the sciences, mathematics and the arts. On the 7th of September 1533, Elizabeth I, daughter of King Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, was born in Greenwich, London. On the 8th of September 1925, Peter Sellers, English actor and comedian, star of The Pink Panther and many other films, was born in Portsmouth, Hampshire. On the 9th of September 1828, Leo Tolstoy, Russian novelist, author of Anna Karenina and War and Peace, was born in Tula, Russia. On the 10th of September 1960, Colin Firth, actor and star of The King's Speech, The Railway Man and other films, was born in Hampshire. On the 11th of September 1885, David Herbert Lawrence, poet and author of Women in Love, The Rainbow and other novels, was born in Eastwood, Nottinghamshire. Finally, on the 12th of September 1913, Jesse Owens, the black American athlete who won four gold medals at the 1936 Berlin Olympics, much to the displeasure of Hitler and the Nazi government, was born in Oakville, Alabama, United States of America. Here are some notable events this week in the past. On the 6th of September 1522, Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan's Spanish expedition, the first to circumnavigate the earth, returned to Spain 3 years after it set out, and without Magellan, who died in battle in the Philippines in 1521. On the 7th of September 1940, the London Blitz began and went on for 57 consecutive nights. On the 8th of September 1966, the Queen opened the Severn Suspension Bridge. Traffic increased over the years and it had to be strengthened, and then a new bridge had to be built to share its traffic loads. On the 9th of September 1543, Mary Stuart, daughter of King James V of Scotland, who died when she was only 6 days old, was crowned Queen of Scots in Stirling at only 9 months old. On the 10th of September 1966, the Beatles album Revolver, which included the songs Eleanor Rigby and Yellow Submarine, went to number one in the charts and stayed there for 6 weeks. On the 11th of September 1297, Scottish rebel leader William Wallace defeated the English army at the Battle of Stirling Bridge in the First War of Scottish Independence. And finally, on the 12th of September 1910, Gustav Mahler's Eighth Symphony, Symphony of 1000, premiered in Munich with 1,028 musicians. It is one of the largest scale choral works in the classical concert repertoire. And that finishes up this edition of Primary. My thanks to Jilly, Steve, Wendy, Deborah, Jane and Christine for reading the news with me, to Angela for providing the radio listings, and John who read them. Thanks also to Vocalise and Zoe Wanamaker, Ian Hanks for the Week in History, and to the indefatigable Rob Pearman for all his help. Primary will be back in 4 weeks' time, back in St Albans. So, with a final glass of Rioja in my hand, it's goodbye from me. Please remember to return your USB stick and wallet after use, and please stay well and safe at home.